From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
The Mission. Excelsior.
Redwood City.
American Canyon.
San Francisco.
Vallejo.
I'm from Redwood City, so I guess that's in the peninsula.
Coming up, we'll take a look at a criminal justice program that brings together the perpetrator and the victim face-to-face.
What we get in a restorative justice process is victims getting to ask questions of the person that did them harm. What were my daughter's last words?
Then we meet a teacher who taught the most challenging and challenged kids in town and turned it into a play.
I hadn't experienced or seen any of the things since the 80s that my students were living and experiencing on the daily.
And what could this signature Bay Area sound be? Take a guess. We'll have the answer from Audiograph coming up. Get ready to be blown away today on Cross Currents. There's a new kind of swap meet happening around the Bay Area lately, where gun owners are trading their firearms for cash. Over the past week, San Francisco and Oakland have each been host to a buyback event, bringing in nearly 260 guns total. In exchange, gun owners were paid $100 for each gun and $200 for each assault weapon with no questions asked. A large part of the funding for the swaps came from crowdsourced donations, including the first known crowdsourced gun buyback held last Thursday in San Francisco's Mission District. KALW's Jasmine Lopez went to 22nd and Cap Street that evening to talk to people who were selling their guns.
So my name is Seamus O'Connell and currently live in the Haight-Ashbury, Coal Valley area.
Hi, I'm Jerry. That's my name. I'm from Richmond.
My name is Marvin Ramirez.
Hi, my name is Vincent Wu. I'm from Visitation Valley in San Francisco.
This old shotgun has been sitting in my closet and under my bed and lying around the house. I picked it up cleaning out an old warehouse with a friend of mine, 12-gauge, Korean-made. It's a skeet shooting gun. It's like the granny gun out of Beverly Hillbillies. A lot like that, a big long barrel. And that's where I got it. I got it for free. Just goes to show you how easy it is to get a gun sometimes.
Well, I came because friends asked me to come to turn in their weapons for them. That's part of the reason. That particular individual, he's seen in people that were close to him get killed, so that makes an impact. So I think that's why he wanted to get rid of them, so nobody else would get their hands on them. They gave me cash money, huh? About $500.
To the people who are turning their guns in, how are you going to defend your family and your children at home in a violent society? Only the police and the criminals will have guns. When the police arrives, you're already dead or they already robbed your house. So how would you defend it?
I do have mixed feelings about this. I think it's a positive thing, but also a negative thing at the same time because, you know, there are pictures here behind me on this wall and some of whom I recognize from in the neighborhood I grew up in. And the fact that kind of gets me is that the gun that was used to murder one of them could be in one of these vehicles or in someone's bag here in line. And, you know, it's going to be destroyed by the police and it'll be gone. It'll be done. It'll disappear forever. There's no questions asked. You turn in the gun. I just did it for my neighbors. They're senior citizens.
Oh, you turned it in?
Yeah, and they're too old. They can't operate them anymore.
Oh,
So their hands are really shaky.
Oh, you brought it in?
So they asked me to do it for them. I said, sure. That's dangerous. They're walking around. They can't do that. They can't do that.
Right,
so I told them I'll do it for them. And I was standing there thinking about it, and this guy, this woman there, I guess she has a picture of her son who was killed, and that's sad, you know. And I was told someone earlier that my friend was killed. And they never caught the killer. He got killed on post in Fillmore and in 2001. Till this day, he's not been found, and he was shot to death, right?
Those voices were recorded by KALW's Jasmine Lopez. All the firearms brought to last Thursday's buyback were taken off-site by San Francisco police to be destroyed. Organizers of the event say they have enough support to hold another one as soon as September. Let us know what you think of the gun buyback approach to reducing violence on our tip line, 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We'll be right back. Some of the people who sold their guns to the buyback program said they wanted to avoid them getting in the wrong hands. That's because gun violence can have such permanent consequences, ones you can't take back. But more and more, victims are coming face to face with the people who committed crimes against them to try to heal and move on from those experiences. The process is called restorative justice, and it includes supportive parties and authorities all coming together at the same table in a safe space. It's an old idea, and not just in the U.S. In fact, in New Zealand, where it was originally used by indigenous Maoris, it's a mandatory part of the formal justice system. In the U.S., these community conferences are increasingly being used in prisons, schools, and as an alternative to juvenile detention. KALW's Leela Day has the story.
Community Works, who are you here to see? I'm going to buzz you in.
I've come to a two-story building in Oakland's Temescal District to see how restorative justice works firsthand. I'm here to meet a teenager arrested for burglary and conspiracy.
And I know we're just kind of waiting on law enforcement. Again, they were contacting, and I do hope they come. If they don't, what I'll do is I'll see if one of my coworkers will come in, and they'll play the role of law enforcement.
That's Jonathan Bradley, a restorative community conferencing coordinator. He's arranged this meeting, but he's a little nervous. He's not sure if everyone will show up. Okay. Already, the victim has refused. So Bradley asked me to sit in as a surrogate. We walk into a room where several chairs are arranged in a circle. Soon after, the tall teen walks in, head down with his grandmother.
Okay.
They don't want to be recorded. Both the teen and his grandmother sit across from me. And right away, she asks how long the meeting will take. She's got to get back to work. A conference coordinator with Community Works comes in to play the part of a police officer, who also didn't show up. She reads a police report with a firm voice. The teen looks down at the ground. Then Bradley asks me to tell a story about when my purse was stolen. Not the same crime this teen committed, but a time that I was victimized. For the first time, the teen looks up at me. He stares straight into my eyes. I tell him I felt paranoid, angry, violated. It happened over a year ago, but I try to be present. He's listening. His grandmother says she'd be so angry if that happened to her. Her arms are folded, just like her grandson's. Bradley asks him to stand up, to write on a big presentation paper everything that he needs to work on. The teen's demeanor changes. He's happy to be writing all of this out, applying for jobs, volunteering at the Boys and Girls Club, talking to kids at a middle school about crime.
What our program requires is that they fix the harm in four areas. They fix the harm to themselves, they fix the harm to their families, they fix the harm to the victim, of course, and they fix the harm to the community.
Bradley has more than 100 cases like this one. He's completed 40 so far. Some of them are serious assaults, burglaries, and robberies, all scheduled to meet their victims face to face.
Ooh, it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to have to apologize.
That's Sujatha Baliga. She's a former defense attorney who was frustrated with seeing so many young people get caught up in what she thought was a broken criminal justice system. Now she works at the National Council on Crime and Delinquency.
I worked with the district attorney to develop what we call the reverse Miranda rule, which means basically the Miranda rule is that anything you say can be used against you in a court of law. Reverse Miranda is that nothing you say can be used against you in a court of law.
Baliga has been training facilitators at Community Works and other sites around the Bay. She's hoping that eventually restorative justice will catch on nationwide.
Hello, it's so much cheaper than adjudicating a youth delinquent. Like when we think about all the court costs of assigning a public defender and this hearing and that hearing. And, you know, I've heard estimates $45,000, $55,000 just to run a kid through the system. You know, we can do this for about $4,000 per kid.
And it's not just keeping kids out of detention centers. It's being incorporated in schools as well. The San Francisco and Oakland Unified School Districts use restorative justice methods to confront conflicts before they spin out of control and lead to suspensions, or worse.
And actually, he was at the police station because he and the other four boys had been apprehended by the police.
I join a mother and her 16-year-old son at their kitchen table in the city of Albany.
And this is, of course, very scary to hear that your son has stolen a car, essentially.
I was in the restorative justice program because during the summer when I was with a bunch of my friends and we were out very late, I had snuck out of my house.
The teen's mom still seems visibly bothered while her son tells the story.
He felt terrible. He initially first felt terrible about having upset his parents and having brought this shame. And it was very, very shameful. I mean, to have handcuffs put on you, to be taken to the station.
The family waited for a court summons. They were expecting some sort of punishment to be handed down. After waiting several weeks, they were notified that the case would be handled by Community Works. The teen remembers his friends and their parents being called into a room. At the victim's request, the policemen who arrested them were there as well. They talked in detail for hours in more than one meeting.
And then we reached this peak where we know we're not going to do this again. We were calling ourselves stupid for what we did. But it kept going. Do you realize what you've done? Do you realize how you've affected this community? And that started to make us feel kind of like, you know, bad, very bad people.
At that session, the teens did not have to confront the owner of the car they were joyriding in the Berkeley Hills. She'd moved. Instead, the victim wrote a letter that was read out loud by the surrogate.
The victim expressed fear, a feeling that anybody around there, because she lived near the school, that any of these kids could have been involved, you know, this sort of basic sense of violation got expressed.
What was your son's reaction to hearing that letter?
I think that he was profoundly sort of shaken by it, in the sense that when he heard that the victim had moved away, he thought, well, maybe she moved because of this. She mentioned that she had a small child and that the small child was affected by what had happened, and he then realized that there was a kid involved here. And I do think that he felt very badly about how the victim had felt.
But the teen tells me he's not so sure if the session really had an impact on him. He thought that the victim not being there herself made it not seem as real. And they often don't show up. Many victims don't want anything to do with confronting the perpetrator. Police often don't show up either. And these are some of several criticisms about restorative justice. Not enough buy-in. Not enough consequence. Nonetheless, Congress has been increasing the amount of federal money for restorative justice programs. Although it's cheaper than sending a child to a detention center, it's still very labor-intensive. Counselors have to check in to make sure promises are kept, rooms cleaned, community service completed, jobs applied for. And on the front end, if the parents, police, or victims don't show up to the conferencing, it can send a message to the kids that it's not important. It's the fundamental strength and weakness of restorative justice, that it only works when everyone is convinced to care. For Cross Currents, I'm Leela Day.
You can hear all of our criminal justice reporting at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Gaining new perspectives by looking at past trials and tribulations isn't exclusive to criminal justice.
I was not told that MS-328 was the hardest school to staff in the district, therefore possibly the city.
Performance artist Safia Martinez has created an entire show out of rehashing her first years as a teacher. At 23 years old, she was looking for a job teaching in public schools in New York. To get her credentials faster, she chose to teach at one of the toughest middle schools in the South Bronx in a program for challenged kids.
That experience and the people she met in her 5 years there are the subject of a one-woman show called So You Can Hear Me. It's playing at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. Martinez utilizes her performing arts training to bring to life a number of characters she met in those 5 years, mostly her students, in hopes of raising awareness about the issues that face inner city special needs programs. Safia Martinez joined me in studio, and I asked her what first struck her when she started teaching. And a warning, this interview contains strong language.
Just having the kids' worlds be proliferated with guns was really shocking and surprising. I wasn't prepared for that at all. And also, I'm, you know, Manhattan born and raised, and Manhattan has plenty of tough neighborhoods, always has. That's less so these days. But, you know, I hadn't experienced or seen any of the things since the 80s that my students were living and experiencing on the daily. So, you know, just having to, for example, if you want to take your kids out to, you know, to the park on a hot day and having there be a shootout, all of these things, you know.
What else?
Having to hit the decks. I also wasn't prepared, and I didn't know how much the gangs had have gotten to our youth. I had no clue that it, you know, I thought individuals do violence and that's how the cycle repeats. But, you know, especially where I was serving, there was a lot of gangs. For the first time, just, you know, if a kid has red in your class, he can't come in. A kid who, you know, who you love and have had successes with, you see him rolling with some people that are 21, in and out of jail, you know, all of these things.
In middle school.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And the boundary and the line between early adulthood and childhood really collapsed. A lot of my toughest kids or the kids that were most heavy in the streets, you know, they'd be a 13-year-old hanging out with 22-year-olds all the time.
Get the out of my desk, yo, and I'll play with you. Shut the up, Miss Martinez. Ain't nobody talking to you. Mother I'm not. So you're not listening? Then that's all right. I'm a idiot. You out. You nasty ass. That's why you let the money and all that ride train on you. You dirty whore. You slut. Shut the up. Now I gotta go. You. You know what I'm saying? You think you fair, but you're not fair. You always side with the girls, man. And this whole class.
And what were these children classified as? Was it a special needs program? Was it, what was it called?
Well, I mean, around the time, especially as I entered the system, they have to mainstream, and they should mainstream children with special needs as well. So they couldn't at that point anymore, which historically had always been the case, segregate it and put children with individual education plans, you know, or IEPs in a different wing of the school and they never see anybody else. That kind of thing wasn't done anymore. So I entered at a time where a lot of mainstreaming was happening. So there's many, many upsides to that, but it's also hard to implement programmatically because then you'll have children who have autism, children that have what they call oppositional defiant disorders, but it's often just like hard living will make kids want to push back a lot more. So you'll have a whole range of disabilities and varying degrees of ability thrown into the same room, and you just have to sort it out. So it's, you know, in the textbook way, it's really great to have a mixed ability class, but when you have an inexperienced teacher with these range of issues going on in the classroom, it's really challenging. So for me, the question is, how can you integrate? How can you mainstream? How do we preserve equity and make it sustainable? Because the truth is, you're just kind of thrown into these situations where, like, very few kids are able to get their needs met based on the inexperience of teachers or infrastructure.
And I'm confronted with a scene of total chaos. I see one kid choking, one kid having an asthma attack, one kid, like, clearly keeled over. I am whacked in the face with the smell of pepper spray, and then I hear a voice that I will remember for the rest of my life. So what, yo, you know what I'm saying? I had some jokes one day. I was like, Shaniqua, well, you ain't got a mom, you ain't got a perm, you foster care, your parents don't love you, but she didn't have to pepper spray my whole face, not even the whole floor. We up out here. Jose.
Now, in your performance,
yes, ma'am.
You bring to life many characters.
Right.
And, you know, one of them really, really drew me in, and it's Jose.
Right.
And it seems like he's this kid that's full of rage and anger, but mm-hmm. at times, you know, kind of apologetic.
He was a sweet enough kid. He was adorable, really. All 90 pounds of him came to my class late and high every day like some excuse about why he was late and high.
Okay, so in the morning, I don't know what the problem is, but I'm hungry. So I have a bacon, egg, and cheese. Then I have a croissant. Then I have like a, you know what I'm saying, like some Tootsie Roll Pops. Then I might have a soft pretzel. Then I have a high C. Then I have a Yoo-Hoo. And I don't know what the problem is, but I'm starving still. And by the time I feel my eyes, no. I think I need to see a thyroid doctor and an ophthalmologist. And you should feel greatly concerned about my health.
I kind of met him at a time where I still had a lot of insecurities about teaching and my ability to teach, but I knew that I was getting better. He destabilized a lot of that for me. He did something totally inappropriate in a class, and I bounced him without even thinking about it, because the truth is, he was the big tipper in my class, and I knew that if I had him, everything else, that, you know, my little kingdom was going to, like, fall apart. So I just pushed through. I expedited his transfer, and he had to go to a much tougher class where literally the second or third day he got pepper sprayed. Literally, when I was going out hitting the block to get a sandwich, I saw this poor child with his eyes all, you know, puffed out. And, you know, he wasn't crying or anything. He was actually, the thing that really caught me was he looked kind of prepared for this moment. You know, he knows where he goes to school. He knows the community he's from. But I felt so responsible, like based on my decision making, he got bounced, got pepper sprayed. And, you know, I had blamed myself in a way. And I said, if I was a more prepared teacher, I would have just been able to keep him.
Yes, sir. I meant no disrespect. I promise. Yes, sir. I'm gonna follow directions. Yes, sir. I'm taking down my hood right now.
What's the takeaway? What do you want people to take away from that intense hour?
What I want people to know is that this is just my effort to tell the truth as I experienced it. And it's in no way, shape, form, fashion to box in or re-stigmatize children that are already up against so much. I just want to be as honest as I can and show as much beauty as I can. And also, the moments where it's intense, it just, the project, it requires that. So it's in the interest of the project, and I do my best to take care of my audience as much as I can, and to also be honest and also just tell some universal things I've experienced about love.
Safia Martinez is an educator and playwright. Her play, So You Can Hear Me, is showing at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco through August 24th. All the details are at kalw.org. It's time for your stories. This is San Francisco StoryCorps. As we heard, sometimes love and understanding are born out of the most challenging experiences. For as long as she could remember, Suzanne Thompson wanted to be a mom, but she was running out of time. She skimmed the list of backup plans: foster parenting, adoption, surrogacy, being a clingy aunt. She thought of her big, happy, divorced family and how this all felt overwhelming and lonely, doing it on her own. She thought of her friend Christopher Nessel and his partner Benjamin Remington, who always wanted to be dads. And she had an idea that could maybe give them all the chance to be parents together. Not sure what all this meant, their friends and family had a lot of questions. To make sure their future child wasn't confused, they sat down with StoryCorps and made this tape for their son, Miles, while he was still in utero.
My name is Christopher Wayne Nossel, and I have with me Benjamin Remington, my significant other slash partner slash we don't have a great vocabulary word for it, and the co-parent of my forthcoming child, Susie.
And I'm Benjamin Remington. I'm sitting here with my partner, Chris Nossel, and my future co-parent, Suzanne Thompson, Susie.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Thompson, or Susie, and I'm here with my baby daddy, Christopher Nossel, and his partner and co-parent, Ben Remington. This all started out as my crazy idea, I suppose. So I've always wanted to be a mom. It's something that I've known my whole life and always kind of imagined as being part of my life. The moment that I realized that it was time to put this plan into action, I was actually on a terrible internet date and starting to do the math in my head as he's talking about who knows what. of like, even if this were the guy, is there enough time to fall in love and get married and then have a kid? And realizing that, no, maybe I was out of time for that, and started to go through the process of actually looking through, you know, sperm donors. And it just struck me that you could choose hair color and eye color and how tall they were. But what I really cared about was, well, is this a good person? Are they smart? Are they funny? Are they, you know, the qualities that I would want to pass on to my child. And so I got the idea of asking Chris and asking him to either just donate sperm all the way through possibly actually co-parenting and kind of a range of different options, because Chris was really the only person that I could imagine attempting this with.
Well, as you might imagine, it felt the most overwhelming compliment I think that a dude can get. And thank you.
But yeah. You tried to say yes right away.
Did I really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I told you, you have to think about it.
Well, I think for me, you know, I knew I wanted to have kids, and I knew that when I did, it was going to be under an unusual circumstance, you know, just by nature of the way that, you know, being a gay man works.
My dad and my mom were both had a ton of questions. Well, wait a minute. Well, who's going to have the kid? Well, what is going to happen around that? It was a litany of questions. They were all fine questions. And as soon as I was able to go, oh, well, it's like we are divorced parents, but without the acrimony. And like light bulbs go off and go, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of a modern family.
I'd say that, you know, whatever emerges, whatever type of person he becomes, he's going to be loved. I mean, by a lot of people.
Suzanne Thompson gave birth to baby Miles this past February. For this StoryCorps, Benjamin Remington spoke with Christopher Nessel and Suzanne Thompson at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco. His interview was facilitated by Kevin Oliver and edited by KALW's Holly J. McDeed. To learn more about how you can participate in StoryCorps, go to our website, kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. All week long on KALW, we've been playing you this sound.
That one is really shaking. See how the top on the far left?
Just... Oh, yeah.
We asked you what you think it is and where in the Bay Area it's from. KALW's Holly J. McDeed brings us the answer.
Every week, people call us with their guesses to the Audiograph game, and they make suggestions, sounds they think are really, really recognizable, like these.
There's an enormous Aeolian harp, which is a wind harp, but it makes sound when the wind blows.
My name is Frida Keeler. A good idea would be the wind sculpture in South San Francisco.
I'd never heard of any famous wind harps in the area, giant or Aeolian, but I was curious. Step one was to find the wind harp, so I gave Frida Keeler a call, mainly because she actually left her phone number, and she agreed to meet me on Grandview Drive in South San Francisco. But it was harder than I thought. While searching for the 92-foot-tall wind harp, I quickly found myself surrounded by Genentech, a biotechnology corporation. The security guard ran after me to see what I was doing on private property.
So I saw you riding your bike, and then I saw he had a big yellow shirt on. He was kind of chubby, and he was like hopping up the mountain after you.
This wind harp was built in 1967 and is one of the world's largest Aeolian harps. It was named for Aeolus, the Greek god of winds. makes sense. All Aeolian harps are named for Aeolus. Wind harps are essentially wooden boxes with strings played by the wind. And this one was no different, just bigger. Keeler and I walked around.
It looks a little bit like the Golden Gate Bridge, and it's made of steel I-beams that are kind of rusted. It's kind of like when you blow on the top of a bottle. It has that sort of hollow sound, but it's much bigger. I think it's kind of spooky. I like it. You can hear it for miles when it's real windy, though.
Mm-hmm. Keeler likes to walk her dog at the wind harp, and she likes the wind harp. She tells me she even wrote a college paper on it.
I compared the wind harp to Genentech because the wind harp is made of steel, which is a natural product, I guess, we mine out of the earth, you know, and it was made by an artist, and it uses the wind to make art, so it seems really natural to me, and Genentech is kind of the opposite, so I compared them.
We kept looking at it, and after a while, we walked away. I got on my bike, and before long, the sound of the mysterious harp had vanished into traffic.
We had some really creative guesses this week, but none of them were right. So this week's winner is the listener who brought us to the wind harp in the first place and so kindly toured us around. Congratulations, Frida Keeler. We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, there will be another contest next week. In the meantime, go to KALW.org for more from Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. That does it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Daniel Moore, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Our executive editor is Ben Trefney. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. The band you're hearing now came about because a few friends were just jamming. That was 45 years ago, and Just Jammin' still plays throughout Northern California. They're part of the 4th Annual Chinatown Music Festival on Saturday from 11 to 5 p.m. You can get all the details at KALW.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.